morning. How are we? Ooh, that sounds loud. The first time I gave the talk an hour ago or whatever, I forgot to turn the thing on. So now I feel much more grandiose. This morning I'm going to talk with you a little bit about a koan from the Blue Cliff Record, case number 80. A lot of you are going to know this very well, and it'll probably be brand new to some of you. It's printed on the program there in front of you. And for those of you who don't have a program, I will read it aloud. The Blue Cliff Record is a compilation of Chinese teaching stories, very famous koan collection. And case 80 reads, a monastic asked Zhao Zhou, does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not? Zhao Zhou said, it is like throwing a ball into the rapids. The monastic later asked Toetze, what is the meaning of throwing a ball into the rapids? And Toetze said, moment to moment, nonstop flow. So that's our story. This koan is well known for a number of reasons, one of which is that it features two very well-known teachers essentially asking or answering the same question. We get to hear from Zhao Zhou and we get to hear from Toetze, who's in our lineage here at Zen Center. And like all koans, there's a number of different things going on, but I'll offer you two different ways this morning of looking at it. The first is sort of the more traditional understanding, that is, this koan is about inquiring into the nature of the enlightened mind. It's a description of the nature of the enlightened mind. And secondly, I'm going to talk about this story playing with awareness versus self-awareness and separateness versus non-separateness. And hopefully you'll sort of see that that's actually one thing. But that's the way I'm going to approach it today. So first, we'll start by looking at this story as an examination of the nature of the enlightened mind. Our hero here, the monastic, asking the teacher, does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not? There are six senses described in Buddhism, the five that we're used to. Smell, taste, touch, smell, taste. What are they? Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. Yeah, there you go. Thank you. And then also mind consciousness is the one that Buddhism adds. Mind consciousness, sometimes translated thoughts consciousness, sometimes translated self-awareness. But they add consciousness to the mix. So that's what they're referring to, for those of you who don't know how Buddhism describes six senses, right? Does a baby possess the six senses or not? He's asking a yes or no question. Do you notice that? You'll notice he does not get a yes or no answer. Because he made the mistake of asking a Zen teacher a yes or no question. The answer, it is like throwing a ball into the rapids, is admittedly pretty confusing. What's the it? What's he talking about? It's like throwing a ball into the rapids? What is the it And am I supposed to be identifying myself as the ball, or am I supposed to be identifying myself as the rapids? What are you talking about? I asked a yes or no question, and I got nothing that I can work with easily. Instead, what he got is an open door into another way of investigating his own question. Right? To answer that question with a yes or no would have killed it. And so his teacher is wise enough to not do that for him. So the way this is traditionally understood is he's asking about enlightenment. Are newborn babies enlightened? That's actually a super good question, don't you think? All of us have looked into the eyes of a newborn baby. You've seen the space there. No self, no other, no up, no down, no good, no bad. Vast space. Blank slate. Is that enlightenment? Is that actually what I'm trying to strive for as a meditation practitioner? Am I looking to actually go back to that? I mean, I had it at one point, obviously. We all do. Is that like where I'm supposed to go? Is searching for enlightenment like a process of addition or putting more things in mind? Or is it a process of subtraction, like getting rid of all the stuff I have that isn't the baby? He's asking a really good question here, right? And I would actually encourage you to ask yourself the question, what's enlightenment? I mean, actually sit with that for a really, really long time. And the reason I encourage you is because I think all of us have preconceived and largely unexamined ideas about what enlightenment is. And if you are here at a Zen center on a Sunday, which is an admittedly strange thing to do, right? You must have at least a relationship of some kind with the E word. There's got to be at least some place back there, right? You've at least heard it mentioned, right? And you know our origin story, this great myth, 500 BC, somebody sits down under a tree as a deluded human, and the thunderbolt happens. And now they're an enlightened being. Like flipping a switch. Click. I wasn't enlightened. Click. And now I am. That's our central myth. In Buddhism, right? That's the Buddhist myth. That's the origin. That's the origin. That's a pretty big word. And it has loads of implications. I'm encouraging you to look at your ideas about what you imagine enlightenment is. Because right now, it is informing your practice. It is informing the way you hear this talk. It is informing, almost certainly, your motivation for being at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center on a Sunday morning at 11:30. You have some kind of idea about what that is. You already have a relationship with that. And looking at what that is really a big deal because it's your filter. Right? It's your filter. If this was a different venue and we had the time, I would go around and say, hey, everybody say a couple sentences about what you understand enlightenment to be. Wouldn't that be fascinating? I would love to hear all the different ways in which that's understood and described. The reason I say it's already informing you is because this is the way the human mind works. If I'm in a relationship with you, and I seek intimacy, and you seek intimacy, we might be looking for two really different things. Because I define intimacy as never fighting. And you defined intimacy as, you can finish my sentences. But until we have the conversation, what exactly is it we're actually doing here at the bottom? We could misunderstand each other for weeks, months, years. And how often we see in Zen stories somebody redefining their understanding of enlightenment after practicing for 50 years. Oh, is that what it was we were doing this whole time? Holy macaroni. And you see this in your relationships too, right? I mean, I just made up an example, but it's like, oh my God, I've known you for 25 years. All I was trying to do is not fight. I thought that was the whole point. I mean, literally, I thought that was like what intimacy is. Fighting is not intimacy, therefore not fighting is intimacy. All I was trying to do is end every argument. That's all I was trying to do. Oh my God, no wonder you never felt seen or heard or valued. Because all I was trying to do is stop a behavior. Holy macaroni. Oh my God, we've been missing each other for 3 decades. Do you see? So all I'm pointing to is Zen is so much about examining what is unexamined, to look at your unexamined preconceived notions about everything, because they're underneath there and they're informing everything, right? Your idea right now about what you imagined the enlightened heart or the enlightened mind to be informs your zazen, and it informs your experience of the liturgy, it explains your experience of this talk, it informs your experience of everything. That doesn't belong because it's not enlightened. That does because it is. Do you sort of see it? So just, I mean, he's asking an incredibly fundamental question here. What is this thing? What even is this thing? What a worthwhile question to spend time with. Please do that. Okay. So, does a newborn baby? Well, a very abiding and persistent idea in meditation circles, Zen included, is that the idea is to have a clear mind, right? Clear mind, enlightened mind. Busy mind, deluded mind, right? I'm seeing a lot of nodding. We're pretty familiar with that idea. To the extent that we can even think of thoughts as being enemies, right? That the enlightened mind would be a non-thinking mind. And that the heart would be a non-moving heart, a non-emotion-feeling heart, right? Because suffering is what we're trying to get away from. So if the heart starts to manifest sadness or confusion or anger, that we're like, ooh, if I can get away from that, that would be enlightenment, right? In fact, it might really, really be enlightenment if it never even showed up to start with. That'd be cool. Like, wow, if no thoughts arose and no emotions arose, surely that would be it, right? Wow. Do you sort of see? That's a very, very persistent idea. So this sort of wiping the slate clean, the baby idea, right? The baby doesn't have self, doesn't have other, doesn't have ideas, doesn't have gender, there's no race, there's no conflict, there's no prejudice. Wow. Surely that's enlightenment. A very persistent idea. That's a very persistent idea. So when he asks this question, our monastic, the answer he gets is, number one, confounding, because his teacher is refusing to answer a yes or no question with a yes or no. And number two, we can probably guess, or at least make the presumption, he gets the opposite of what he's looking for. Because the answer is, it's like throwing a ball into the rapids. And that is not an image of cleanliness or calmness or stillness. In fact, it is the opposite of those things. It's easy for all of us who live here in Minnesota to imagine being at a state park, let's say Banning, and you're there by the rapids and you can hear the rapids and you can smell it, right? Because the spray is coming up and you throw a beach ball out there and it's loo, 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 loo. It's turning around and bouncing up and down and then getting caught on a branch and then back again. Loo, 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 and spinning and it's bouncing and it's right. That's the answer he gets. It's like throwing a ball into the rapids. Like, what? No, no, no. That's the mind I came here with. That's what I'm... What are you talking about? He's given an image of chaos, of activity, of constant motion, of change, of bouncing, of bouncing, of bouncing. Do you get it? Holy cow. What an answer. It's like throwing a ball into the rapids. No wonder he's puzzled by it. No wonder he's puzzled by a ball tossed on boundless, rushing water. So no wonder it is not a surprise, perhaps, that he asks a second teacher. Some accounts say this would have been years and years later. He would have asked a second teacher at another monastery, at another stage of his practice. But who knows? It's a story. It's still alive for him, obviously. It's not leaving him alone. So he asks his second teacher, Totsa, what is the meaning of throwing a ball into the rapids? This has been driving me nuts. What is he talking about? A ball into the rapids? Come on, give me something I can work with here. And the second answer, moment to moment, nonstop flow. I don't know, does that make it better? What I notice about that answer is that the second teacher is reifying what the first teacher said is constant, constant, constant activity and motion. Kind of the same answer. What I also notice about the second answer is he's helping him at least a little by taking away the ball. No more ball. Just the motion. I'm kind of giving you a nudge here. Do you sort of get it? when I imagine, like a lot of us do, like most of us do, like most of us do most of the time, I do experience my life as if I was a ball on rapids. It is happening to me. It is happening at me. Why won't it stop? Does that sound a little bit like your life? I hope. For those of you listening to the podcast at home, everybody nodded. They all nodded in agreement. Their eyes shining like diamonds. It keeps happening. It keeps happening. It keeps happening. It keeps happening. The turbulence, the change, the flow keeps happening. Do you feel the relationship with the flow? It's outside of me. It is separate from me. It happens to me. So often I experience it as an adversary. So often I experience it as afflictive. Right? Right after the unpaid bill came, then came the fight with the neighbor, then came the traffic jam, then came the light on the dashboard saying, service engine soon. They keep happening to me. The waves keep happening. Why does it keep happening to me? There is a ball and there is rapids. And so Zazen becomes an extension of that same relationship. I'm going to go to Zen Center, and that'll be great, because I'll sit there and I'll figure out a way to keep the ball from moving. I'll just still the friggin' rapids, and then I can buy me some sweet. Do you get it? Of course that's our relationship with it. It's very, very human. That view is married to the idea of our separateness. It's very much married to an idea of victimhood. Things happen to us that we don't choose. Do you sort of feel it? How real that separation is? How vulnerable that makes us? How instinctual it would then be that all of our effort would be extended outward? If I could just control these things, obviously that would lead me to greater safety and greater security. So I spend as much time as I can calming the rapids. Right? Calming the rapids. Of course that's what I spend time doing. You sort of? Yeah. So this lovely monastic who I identify with, I really, really empathize, he does get the same answer twice. Like, this is it. This is the motion. This is the movement. Admittedly, the second teacher gives him a little bit more, like, maybe forget the ball thing. You know, you've already got that down. You already feel that way. All humans do, right? I'll give you a little nudge. But this idea of the mind in motion, mind moving so fast that nothing can grasp it, this is how Zen talks about consciousness, folks. This is how Zen talks about enlightenment, that enlightenment can include this. So do you feel how, even as I say that idea, you have to get bigger in order to allow that to be true? Do you feel it? That enlightenment, your enlightenment, has to include this. It has to include the rapids and the ball and the fact you don't want that. It's got to be bigger. Do you feel there's an expansion there? As opposed to, oh, all you're doing is getting a really strong mental muscle so that you can calm the waves every time and you can continue to eliminate them. Does that make you feel expanded? It doesn't. You can actually feel constriction there, can't you? Isn't that fascinating? You can actually feel this. I mean, physically, it happens in your heart. You go, oh, if I could just get rid of... You can feel it's constriction, isn't it? Wow, my heart just got a little smaller. We don't create or force calm or stillness of the undisturbed lake. It happens. It's lovely. It's fine. But instead, Zen puts all of its energy, all of its eggs in the basket of learning to settle into that which stops trying to control. That stops trying to eliminate anything about what your mind is naturally and already doing. Isn't that interesting? It is not lost on me that people are actually drawn to rapids and waterfalls. We love that stuff. Something actually happens to your mind when you watch a waterfall. If the goal was, can you isolate and follow one drop, you'd go nuts. And it'd be really, really stressful. And if the goal was, identify yourself with one drop and don't go over the edge because something horrible is going to happen to you at the bottom because you're going to stop being separate and then you're going to get absorbed into the up too late, that'd be an incredibly stressful experience for you. But you don't do that because you're wise as a human and you just watch the flow happen. Why do we experience this as relaxing? We do, right? You like universally, we experience that as relaxing. We even listen to like audio recordings as we're trying to go to sleep. Oh, I'm going to put on a waterfall. That's awesome ambient noise. It'll help me go to sleep. Wow, that sounds so nice to me. The activity of motion. Why is it calm? Why is that soothing? Why does that open us up? Because we observe it. Isn't that interesting? We observe it. We watch it. And that watching has no grasping, no desire to control. Ooh, I don't like the rapids there. They should be a little better, a little bigger, a little smaller, a little taller, a little shorter. You just watch it, don't you? And there's something that happens when you just watch. Such kindness arises in our hearts, such benevolence. This kind of mind that doesn't try to control, it doesn't try to eliminate anything. It just notices what's already happening and goes, wow. That's the answer our monastic gets from his teachers. Is there a way of observing your own experience? Is there a way? So when we talk about consciousness this way, as ceaseless functioning, when we talk about enlightenment even, this way, as ceaseless activity, does that make your goal of enlightenment seem farther away for you? Or does it make it feel closer? I think that's an interesting question. We're back to where we started. What is enlightenment? Suzuki Roshi said, strictly speaking, there are no enlightened people. There's only enlightened activity. Right? Strictly speaking, there are no enlightened people. There's only enlightened activity. That's this koan. When I first read that, I found that extremely puzzling, and then I understood it a little bit, and then I found it extremely upsetting. Right? Because the central myth, I misunderstood. He was ignorant, then he was enlightened. Those are two static things. Do you feel the staticness of him? Delusion, 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 delusion. Enlightened, 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 enlightened. Do you feel it? He is static, and his state of mind is static. The light was never on, now the light is always on. Do you feel it? What a binary. Of course I understood it that way. I mean, of course, it's taught that way oftentimes. I totally get that. Right? This isn't me being an idiot. But in another sense, it's me going, hold on a minute. That goes against the nature of every single experience I have ever had as consciousness in form as a human being. I have never had an experience that did not leave. Ever. I never had a thought that did not leave. I never had an emotion that did not leave. I never had a physical sensation that did not change and leave. It's literally impossible. I have never once ever had that experience. But my idea of enlightenment kept insisting on it. It kept insisting on it. It kept insisting on it. And the way that I understood the central story of Buddhism, and the way that I understood enlightenment in this tradition called Zen, because I saw it through that lens, kept reifying it and reifying it and reifying it. Oh, you're still struggling because you're still not there. You're still not there. How do you know you're still not there? Because I still get cranky and I still get angry in traffic and my wife and I just sometimes don't connect and sometimes I'm on toast and there's no toast. Right? I'm still suffering. I must be doing it wrong because surely Buddha would never argue with his wife and never gets triggered in traffic and always have toast when he wanted toast. That's what enlightenment is, right? It's like bulletproofness. I identified it so strongly with the calm lake that never has a wave. Can you feel the amount of judgment that arose in my heart in response to that idea? And I never knew it was there. Can you imagine what the landscape of Zazen was like for me? There's another thought. I'll translate that for you. There's another failure. Steve's going to ring the bell in 40 more minutes because that's how long traditional Zazen sittings are. How many times does there's another failure show up? Because there's a feeling, now I'm sad, now I'm angry, now I wish he was ringing the bell, now my knee hurts, now my brain is busy, now I'm thinking about the past, I'm not supposed to be thinking about the past, I'm supposed to be in the present, now I'm thinking about the future, oh, I'm not supposed to be thinking about the future. Do you feel it? Because I'm looking for enlightenment, right? The rapids are bad. Wow, can you see the suffering there? Holy macaroni. These teachers are giving this guy an unbelievable open door. I have no idea. Of course, we never hear the ending of these stories, you know. We never know what happens. But what an open door. You can redefine all of what you have just shown me. They are really doing what all good Zen teachers do. Hold up a mirror. Do you see what you are? Do you see how you're creating your own suffering? Do you see it? Can you expand? Can you get bigger? Can you hold more so that that doesn't keep happening? I see that you're hurting. I am so sorry. You get to change that. I refuse to answer the question. I refuse to take away the thing that you need to get free. Wow. There are no enlightened people. There's only enlightened activity. Activity, flow, the rapids. Do you get it? Whoosh, whoosh. The wisest, kindest, most amazing person in the world who's benevolent 10 minutes ago was super cranky and she cut me off on the freeway. Right? And Mother Teresa was so devoted and then her faith got ready and she was really mean to her underlings. Oh. And Martin Luther King had an affair and Gandhi was really angry and sometimes treated his sons terribly. What do we do with this? What do we do? Do we expect there's some sort of a static stuckness that comes called enlightenment and then it never goes? Do you see how I'm projecting all of my own split onto him, onto them, onto it? This is the idea, right? Zen is so good at saying, take that back, take that back. The flow is here. Look at the flow. Do you understand what that comes from? Why did you get constricted right there? What happened? This is your ancient twisted karma. You claim to avow it. You claim to avow all of it. Why won't you? Yeah, I can see that you're tracking here. Consciousness flows without ceasing. Another way of saying that is, here we go again. It'll always be easy, and then hard, and then easy, and then hard again. Dogen called that the circle of practice. The circle of practice. Tim calls it no enlightened off-ramp. Isn't that nice? Depending on how you see it, it's nice. No enlightened off-ramp. If you're familiar with the Heart Sutra, at the core of our tradition, the core of our liturgical expression, I would ask, are you not an infinite being? Actually, even if you're not familiar with the Heart Sutra, I would ask, are you not an infinite being? And if you are, in fact, an infinite being, what does that make the end of practice look like? I mean, what does that make the start of practice look like? If your inquiry is really skillful, you'll see that there aren't either one of those things. There can't be a start. Can't be an end. So now what happens to enlightenment? Does that take it away? Or does that just make it really, really big? Way bigger than whatever it was we came here today with. I mean, does your potential for growth have a ceiling? Does it have an end? Can you grow just so far? And then you're done because you hit enlightenment. You're done. I mean, you're done, right? The road race is 26.2 miles. When you make it 26.2 miles, you're done at the road race. Is that the way human beings are? Is that the way spiritual capacity is? Is that the way love works? Does compassion have a ceiling? Does wisdom have a ceiling? Is there an end? You know, when Tim first said no enlightened off-ramp, I was sort of like, oh, that's funny. He's using traffic as a metaphor for the path. And I was sort of like, well, he must be talking about somebody else. Because there's got to be an off-ramp. That's what I'm here for. This is really hard. This is called samsara. This is the world of suffering. This is the world of struggle. This is the world of constriction. This is the world of limited ideas about self and other and conflict. I want the off-ramp. Why do you think I'm here? Right? That's the whole reason I walked through the door. Because it said off-ramp over it. Right? Of course I want. That's the central myth. When Buddha becomes Buddha, he breaks the cycle. He never has to come back into samsara again. Wow. Mahayana Buddhism, which admittedly comes a little later, quite a bit later, introduces us to something called the Bodhisattva ideal. And I know most of you in this room know exactly what that is. The four rows of kanji there next to our bell describe it perfectly, the four vows. We'll chant them at the end of the talk. And that chant goes as far out of its way as it possibly could to make sure we understand this is limitless. There's no such thing as a beginning or an end. And we say yes to all of it. So we say yes to an infinite number of dharma gates, teachings we have yet to learn. We say yes to an infinite number of delusional moments of not getting it. Right? That our enlightenment includes that. It's a very Dogen idea. It's a very Soto Zen idea. It's a very, very Mahayana idea. And it changes the scope of practice for us. Norman Fisher, I think, correctly describes the Buddhist path as infinite suffering met with infinite love. Nonstop flow, nonstop suffering, nonstop love. That's the Bodhisattva vows. That's the heart of what we're doing here. We love the imperfect and the broken and the misguided and the deluded, the pockets of suffering, the moments of anger. Our enlightenment doesn't come when they are gone. Our enlightenment is what is big enough to love them and include them and hold them, right? Do you feel the difference between those two? I'm not asking if you understand the difference between the two of those. I'm asking if you feel it. Right? The tuning fork for your practice is in the middle of your chest. It's not between your eyes. And you can literally feel which one of those is loving and which one of those is not. So, when we talk about this path not ending, when we talk about the path being limitless, when we talk about something that has this kind of scope, moment-to-moment, nonstop flow, what do you notice in your own experience when you check in with your feelings, when you check in with your thoughts, when you notice your body? What do you notice your ego doing in response to that idea? There are no right answers here. I'm just asking for noticing. What do you notice about your striving? Right, the part of you that strives and grasps and wants. What do you notice about what this model, this map of the path does to that? What does it do to your despair? Surely we all have moments. Surely we all have moments of great despair. What does the idea of never ending do to that? I don't know. I think for some of us the idea of nonstop flow would be terrifying. And I think for some of us, the idea of nonstop flow would be deeply comforting. And I'm guessing for most of us, they could be both. The teacher is really giving a very strong answer here. You can feel the no off-ramp, can't you? You can feel the no escape. And then you can feel the kindness and the wisdom in that no escape, right? So, the nature of the enlightened mind. All right, I will shift gears and talk about this very briefly. Through another lens. And the other way I'm going to talk about this koan this morning is that it is about awareness versus self-awareness. Separateness versus non-separateness. And the reason I'm doing it this way is because one of the qualities of the consciousness of a newborn, right, which is our metaphor, one of our metaphors here is like, does a newborn baby have this? One of the qualities of consciousness of a newborn is that it is boundless, it is wide open. All of us who have held a newborn and looked into its eyes know, wow. It's like looking into the night sky, isn't it? It's incredible. It's just, there's nothing but space. It just goes and goes. Oh, You know, what happens to your heart when you look into that? Wow. But we also know, even though we're looking at awareness, it does not yet have self-awareness. Do you get it? You have something that it does not. You are self-aware in the way that the newborn is not. Right? So the idea then of meditation or enlightenment or Zen practice being to return you to a sense of not self-awareness starts to become kind of an interesting question, doesn't it? Is the whole idea of a separate self or even an ego self or even self-awareness at all like just fundamentally poison? Like, are we born Buddha and then we just get worse until we die? Right? Because we learn and we keep having more and more ideas and more divisions and more concepts and we just get stupider and stupider and stupider until we're dead. Wow. Buddhism. Right? I'm asking this. I mean, I'm being a little glib here so you kind of get it, but this is a really pervasive idea, you guys. To know stuff is the enemy. And you're like, wow, why would that be? That's interesting. Like, self-awareness is a natural functioning of human consciousness. Ideas are a natural functioning of human consciousness. Emotions are a natural function of human consciousness. The ability to discern what might be healthy or life-supporting in any given moment is a natural development of human consciousness. Why are we spending as much time as some of us do making those things enemies? That seems really confusing right now. I have also heard, this is a little bit of a stretch from the newborn baby thing, but not too much, because we guess that we are the only species on this planet that has self-awareness, right? We get to know we are humans who know that we are humans, right? How many times have I heard, oh, my dog is the best Zen teacher of all. That's what I want, to be like my dog. Oh, he's always so happy to see me when he comes home. Oh, and he wags and he wags and he wags, and he's always in the moment. Oh, he's always in the moment. He makes Eckhart Tolle look like a rank amateur. My dog is clearly winning. Again, I'm being a little funny here. You've heard this, though, right? You've heard that. Like that everything is fine except humans. We're the broke ones. We're the part of creation that doesn't get it. All animals are born. All animals eat and reproduce and die. Humans are the only ones who worry about it. Right? You've heard that. That's funny. It's true. I'm asking really, like, this is actually, we're asking all these questions in the light of what is enlightenment. Is my goal to be my dog? Would that actually be better? Would my goal be to be the newborn who does not have thoughts? Would my goal be to be the plant that does not have self-awareness? Wouldn't a rock be even better? Is consciousness fundamentally a good thing? When it evolves and becomes self-aware and then gets complex, is it moving in the wrong direction? There's a lot going on in this koan, isn't there? Wow. If enlightenment is the vast, vast, vast heart that we have been told that it is, surely the invitation is to include more, include more, include more, include more, become aware of more, hold more, accept more, inquire about more, say yes to more. Surely it isn't a less, 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 bad, 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 bad. It has to be an expansion, or we wouldn't call it enlightenment. We'd call it endarkenment, because it'd be getting smaller and smaller, and we'd be less and less aware, and our circle of awareness would get smaller and smaller and smaller. Self-awareness. So, there's another talk to be given on another day about what self-awareness is and what self-awareness is not, meaning the way that you behold the river, the waterfall, your emotions, your life, your thoughts, your experience, whether that is loving, whether that is wise, pardon me, whether that is compassionate. That's another question. But I want to end with this, because I'm running low on time here. Recently I read something in an article that was talking about a term that a NASA astronaut invented called the overview effect. Have some of you heard? There's a few hands. Heard of the overview effect? It's relatively new. Someday I assume this will be a really well-known term. What they're talking about is the effect on human consciousness that spending extended periods of time and space has. And they use the word overview because when you've looked out the window and seen all of the earth for an hour, for a day, for a week, for a month, for 6 months, it changes the consciousness of the person who's having that experience, right? And studies are just beginning now, as you can imagine, to be done on what that actually does to human consciousness. We're studying the physiology of space, and we're studying all the biochemistry and the things that happen to other growing things and heliotropism and all sorts of stuff. What happens to the human heart when it beholds everything that humans self-define as, we are beings from this planet, right, that I'm now looking at in its entirety through a window. What effect on my consciousness does that have if I'm exposed to that for 6 months, let's say? Right? So there's lots to be learned, but the two things that they've noticed so far, and these are my words, not theirs, because this is science and I'm not that. One is a sense of the smallness of the individual life. Right? It's kind of like when you're taken off on a plane and you're like, oh my God, they look like ants from up here. Well, if you're in space, you can't even see the ants. Right? They're down there fighting with their spouses. They're down there angry about elections. They're down there judging and blaming and, you know, playing with kids and painting their room another shade of blue. They're doing their human thing down there. It's very, very important. I got to get the right kind of paint, right? And then whoop, from up there, it's like, oh, sweetie, you think that's important. Oh, my God, you're so wrapped up in that ball on the rapids. Oh, do you see it? You know, the long view, God cam, right? The overview effect. They're way, wow, the smallness. And then the fascinating thing to me is that the second thing they're noticing is the response to that is a sense of the immense entirety of the importance of that one little individual life. Instead of devaluing all those little ants down there, they see so clearly through the lens of their heart, oh my God, it is incredibly important. Do you see how you can hold both of those? It's not that big of a deal. It's okay. It's nonstop flow. The traffic jam goes away. The fight goes away. The blue paint goes away. It's okay. But that doesn't make it not important. Instead, it replaces it with, it is everything. Isn't that interesting? The attachment goes away. The clinging, do you feel it? The grasping, the constriction goes away. Right? But the relationship between the wave and the lake doesn't. You see them both. So what these people are describing is an opening of the heart. That's the short version. Their hearts crack open because they look down at the planet, and instead of just going, wow, what a bunch of insignificant little things running around, they fall in love with all of us. Just like you would if you beheld the entirety of the earth through that window, you would, I love all of it. Every single thing. It's me. The only logical response is love. You would see the infinity of it, and your response would be love. You wouldn't dare to exclude anything. We're talking about the enlightened mind today. This is one of the invitations of this practice. The overview effect is not limited to people who orbit the earth. They get a really cool set of tools that help them with this, but it is in no way limited to them. We get black cushions instead. Right? Same thing. Can you see it all? Can you hold it all? Can you include it all? Can you love it all? Now our metric for the enlightened mind changes. That's the invitation, I think, here. I encourage you to spend more time with this story yourself. I'm no expert on the Blue Cliff Record. You are. Right? The koans are for you. See what it shows you. And I hope the invitation, whatever it is, shows up as you seeing a little more deeply and a little more kindly into what you really are. So, thank you very much. We have time for just maybe one or two questions or comments. I want to make sure we have enough time for announcements today. Does anybody have anything they'd like to offer? Has anybody ever been in space? Okay, rats. Someday I'm going to have somebody raise their hand. Oh, yes, I was on the International Space Station for 6 months, and then I'm going to go crazy and ask for their autograph. Charles, what can I...
I just wanted to... to sort of mention like the idea of enlightenment being binary. It kind of reminds me of like when I was younger, thinking about Christianity and also like some Eastern European, the idea of like Marxism, where you're going to get something right, and then you're going to, like, there's this one thing, the silver bullet, you got to get it right, and then you're going to go to heaven,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have communism, and everything's going to be magical and perfect. And that's something that I really struggled with when I was like a kid.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I got to get this one thing perfect, and then I get that those straight A's, and then the next semester rolls around, and it's not smooth sailing. I've got to keep doing work, and it's frustration and everything. So it's sort of just like letting go of that. And I don't know that that makes you enlightened, but it's a step of getting rid of this like silver bullet solution mindset.
You're right on. It's very it's human. I mean, it shows up in corporate settings and relationship settings and religious settings and the idea of arriving. We really love the idea that we're going to arrive, don't we? Man, we want to arrive. I tell you. Yeah, I'm right with you. Good for you. Please.
Thank you very much for this teaching. Happened at so many levels that I've been thinking about it for a long time. But I really... in my sort of simple mind, I'm drawn to water metaphors. I really like water and the notion of flow and connectedness with easy to be in the water. And your Dharma talk brought me back to a moment of sort of experiencing that delusion of control when a friend and I got caught in a riptide at the ocean. And so, of course, we started trying as hard as we could to get back to the coast, and then people on the beach were saying, stop. And we did, and, you know, we went farther out, which was scary, and then suddenly the flow stopped, and we had enough energy back to swim back to shore. And so that sort of feeling of that you have to fight the flow, but really it's better.
Thank you. I love it. Swimming is I always think of swimming metaphors. Because water really works, and the power of water, and what it means to stay afloat versus to swim, and what's the difference between like falling down and doing a somersault. I mean, the more we look at body is a great metaphor, and water is especially a good one. That's why I think Zen uses water so often, the idea of flow. I think we stole it from the Taoists, did we not? I don't know who I'm looking at here, but Zen stole a lot from the Taoists, and water, oh yeah, your ability to flow, we're going to conquer. No, man, you're just flowing. It's much more groovy, sort of, you know. All right, well, I will turn this over to our Doan and our announcements. Thank you very much for your attention this morning. I'm grateful to you.